Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hey there, how are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah? Are you logging some National Bike Challenge miles?
I am, actually.
So, Rob Guskey is now sending us emails every single week. This week, he said that they are on track to reach 1 million miles.
10 million, isn't it?
Oh, I thought it was 1 million. Well, whatever it is, they're on track. I wrote it down as 1 million, but I could be wrong. They are not, however, on track to reach 50,000 riders. And that's where, you know, they're hoping that we can encourage people to sign up. I think everybody who listens and is in the U.S. is probably signed up if they want to do it. But we'll see.
Yes, they're at, it is 10 million miles, by the way.
Oh, it is. Okay.
They're at 25,000 riders.
So they're only 50% of the riders, but over what they expected at this point for miles.
Miles is, I have to read this chart here.
Yeah, I couldn't read it.
About 5 million so far.
Whoa!
Yeah, so they're going to far exceed 10 million by the end of the season.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Do you know how awesome our listeners are?
Well, I've got a pretty good idea.
So this week I received an email from Ray in North Carolina. He was so cute. I just have to share it. So here's what he said. I listened to The Outspoken Cyclist via your podcast and my sixth generation iPod. I laughed at that. It's a tiny little bugger with a touch screen, perfect for carrying on the bike and listening to while I'm on my bus commute to work. I commute via bus and bike every day.
Hmm.
So he's logging his miles. Now, since you are, quote, one of the Northerners, a.k.a. damn Yankees, you have a tendency to speak very fast. Or is it that my redneck ears have a tendency to hear everything fast? So one day as I listened to my favorite podcast, you and Greg were speaking at your normal fast pace and then some. You had kicked up the speed a notch or two. I listened to several shows, having to pay close attention to you so my brain could process what you were saying at something nearing Mach speed. Oh, and it was everybody that were talking that fast. I don't remember how long this went on, but somehow I found a tiny little soft button on the iPod screen. Yeah, you got it. 1.5X, it said. Damn, why is that there? Steve Jobs had added the button that speeds up the audio 1.5 times. Why? I just had to laugh at myself when I found the reason for your super fast talking abilities. So, Diane, I apologize for thinking you had kicked your talking habits into a high gear just to piss me off, Ray. And he added a little smiley face at the end. Brian and I just laughed out loud when we
nice.
Heard that. Isn't that cute?
No, we're not trying to irritate listeners.
Sometimes, on the other hand.
Sometimes it happens. Real quick, while we're talking about listeners, to send a shout out to Mike from Honda of Mentor.
Oh?
I discovered that one of the service advisors at my Honda dealer is a regular listener on his way home from work on Saturdays. So, hi, Mike. How you doing?
And he works on your Honda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He listens to Joe Madigan and then rolls right into The Outspoken Cyclist.
Well, so. There you have it.
Yeah.
We have a show to do.
Okay. Let's get started.
It's going to be a good one. Our first guest this evening is a freelance writer and author. His name is Ian Dilley. Ian has co-authored The Price of Gold, The Toll and the Triumph of One Man's Olympic Dream, about Marty Nothstein. Now, Marty is arguably one of the greatest cyclists of all time. He's garnered multiple national, international, and Olympic medals on the track. Marty grew up near the Trexlertown Velodrome in Pennsylvania and still lives in the Lehigh Valley. The book hooked me from the first page. It was so well written. I read it straight through. Ian is going to be talking with us about how he got to be the co-author of this book, and what he learned about Marty Nothstein. He'll be talking to us from his home in Austin, Texas, Lance Armstrong country.
Yep.
Then we're going to talk with Steve Miller. No, not Fly Like an Eagle, Steve Miller. No. This is Steve Miller, who's president of the Tour of Utah. The Tour of Utah is the U.S. toughest stage race. And Steve is the Tour of Utah, knows the event inside and out. tour is coming up the first week of August and has a new component for amateur racers. And then finally, we're going to be speaking with Joe Friel. Now, anybody who knows triathlons probably has Joe Friel's triathlon training Bible on their shelf. But he wrote other books, 10 of them exactly, including his newest, which is Your First Triathlon, the second edition. And it's exactly what you'll need if you're going to swim, bike, or run for the first time. So he's going to be talking to us from Scottsdale, Arizona. So let's scoot on down to Austin, Texas, as we welcome author Ian Dilley to the show. Ian, thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So I know you're a freelance journalist, and you've done a lot of interesting stories. But I have to tell you, this one, The Price of Gold, I think is about as fascinating as it gets.
Oh, thank you. That's very encouraging to hear. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, how did you become involved in the project to co-author the story of Marty Nothstein's pursuit of his Olympic gold medal?
I was recommended for the project by my editors at Bicycling Magazine.
Aha.
So I was, Rodale, kind of, they're deeply involved in the velodrome, and they, had approached Marty about doing this book. He agreed, and then I was hired as the writer to work with him.
Well, of course, Rodale is in Emmaus, and that's right near the velodrome. So, and Marty has lived there his whole life. So I guess that makes perfect sense to me.
Right. And Bob Rodale actually built the velodrome there. He was an Olympian himself. He was an Olympic skeet shooter, and he fell in love with track cycling while traveling internationally. He first saw it at the Pan Am Games and, thought it was a really cool sport and wanted to bring it to the Lehigh Valley where Rodale, the Rodale company, is based. And so he built the velodrome, and then about 10 years later, a kid named Marty Nothstein discovered it and started racing there and went on to win an Olympic gold medal.
Yeah, he sure did. And boy, what a story it is, too. So were you actually able to spend some time with Marty face-to-face?
Yeah, definitely. I would say I spent about a month to 6 weeks total with him over the course of the year. I took three separate trips of about 10 days to 2 weeks. And, we spent a lot of time face-to-face and went on bike rides and drank some beer and, became good friends.
Well, he just seems, what an intense guy. Is he still intense. Real intense?
he's a bit more mellow now than he was during his racing days, that's for sure. He can still turn it on when he needs to, but that was really a persona that he had to embody to compete at that level, and is really a mindset that allowed him to be that aggressive on a bicycle and to be able to endure the type of training that he put himself through, and that's something that we really tried to recount in the book is, how that intense mindset started to take a toll on him and kind of, overwhelmed him at times.
Yeah, and that became very obvious. How did you choose, obviously it was the two of you, but how did you choose to write it in the first person? I think from the first page, it's just riveting, right, from the very beginning.
Yeah, I think it was always going to be in his voice. That was for certain. The decision I made in writing it was to set it in the present tense. Some other sports memoirs I read and that were recommended to me were set in the present tense, and I found that it really kept the reader in the scene a lot better and was a nice device for kind of telling the story chronologically and moving the reader through the story and keeping them engaged. Andre Agassi's Open was certainly kind of a sports memoir book that, is highly regarded, and that was one I read and was influential.
Well, it did exactly that. It kept you engaged continually, and I also like the way it was broken up sort of one complete thought and then the next complete thought. He was obviously just about as driven an athlete as I've ever heard of. I mean, he just really beat himself up constantly to be the very best. Do you know how he got the name The Blade?
I do, and it, you know,
are we allowed to say?
It was a story of much debate. We had a lot of back and forth about the actual story of his nickname that we were going to put in the book. You know, the story that ended up in the book, and this is certainly true, is that you know, one day, you know, I think he was a teenager. He was kind of lagging behind in a race. On the last lap, he, you know, ducks and dives and weaves through the whole field and, you know, beats the last rider across the line, you know, by a razor-thin margin. And an older racer says, "Man, you cut through those that pack like a blade." And that's how he got the nickname The Blade. And the other story, which Gil, who's his longtime coach, told me, which Marty claims is patently untrue, is that he wore a pair of Oakley Blades, you know, night and day as a kid, because they were the first cool sunglasses he was able to buy. And so Gil took to calling him The Blade. And I had originally had that in the book, and, you know, Marty assured me that Gil completely made that story up, and so we took it out.
Well, Gil seemed to be a very instrumental part of Marty's life while he was training and racing.
Yeah, I mean, he was his corner man. You know, he was right there beside him from, you know, Marty's very first day at the track. You know, he was one of the coaches that taught Marty how to race on a velodrome, you know, all the way through to the Olympic gold medal. It's pretty incredible. You know, they really, you know, formed a close bond, and to this day they remain, you know, super close, and, you know, spend a lot of time together, either riding or hunting in the woods, and, you know, it's, they have a special relationship.
Well, I really learned a lot about track racing from the book. I can't imagine anybody reading the book and not being enamored of the idea of track racing. The speed and the intensity and just the way a race starts and the way racing happens, you really got a good picture of how track racing works from the book. Were you able to see some racing yourself while you were writing it?
I did. Yeah, my last trip up to T-Town, the Masters National Championships was taking place at the track, as well as the Friday night pro racing. So I got to watch a night of pro racing, which was really fun. And, you know, it's kind of like the Friday night lights of Pennsylvania. It's their high school football scene. You know, it's the whole community comes out, and, you know, they serve beer, and, you know, it's just a great evening of racing and watching racing. And then also, Marty kind of came out of retirement for one race and ended up winning a Masters National Championship in, scratch race, I believe. And it was a really exciting race to watch. And, you know, him and his old buddy Irv, kind of tag teamed the race, and Marty took the gold, and, yeah, it was fun seeing the blade back in action.
Yeah, I'll bet it was. Well, I know that reading about how he got the silver in Atlanta just drove him so crazy so that he would come back and win the gold. It was literally all he thought about for all those years. And boy, that came across so intensely in the book. And you know, I know the title says Price of Gold, but, you know, all the way along, you're not 100% sure, was he really going to get that gold medal? And every single step of the way, it was just so well explained. I really got a lot out of it about track racing. I love it. I want to go watch track racing now. What are some of the surprising things you learned about Marty?
You know, his relationship with his family was really interesting to me. That's a part of his life that he keeps pretty private, and I was kind of walking on pins and needles, you know, trying to explain his relationship, you know, with his own mom and dad in the book and their relationship, and also, you know, the relationship he had with his wife while he was, you know, preparing for to win the gold medal, and also, you know, kind of how their relationship evolved and his relationship with his own children. You know, I think one thing I tried to make clear at the end of the book is that, you know, he is a great dad and an incredible father, and a lot of people, and that was a big part of the price that he paid in being an Olympian, was that he didn't have time for his kids or have time for his family. You know, his wife was tasked with most of the caretaking of the children, you know, and he pretty much just trained and raced and ate and slept. And so I think discovering that and trying to delve into that world was surprising, and it's a world most people, you know, don't really let you into, but he was, in the end, he was pretty open with that, and I thought it came across nicely.
Oh, it came across very well. The question was, you know, was he going to be able to reignite that relationship so that, you know, he could come home and be home? Because he certainly mentally, physically, emotionally was somewhere else for those years, you know. But obviously his wife understood it. And the kids, I don't know what kids do and don't understand. It's hard to say. But I know his son is, like, right in his footsteps.
Yeah, Tyler is a great kid, you know. Both his kids, Tyler and Devin, are just really fun to be around. And, you know, they're both excited about bike racing. You know, they have other interests, too. But it seems like they live a pretty good life there in the Lehigh Valley. And you know, Christy is a great mom, and they definitely have a very nice, you know, post Olympic phase of Marty's life is seems to be going pretty well.
That's very cool. So, what's next on your agenda? That took some time. How long did it take actually to write this book?
It was pretty quick.
Really,
the whole project came together in about a year.
Oh, not bad. Not bad.
Yeah, so I spent you know, most of the last year working on this book, and then right now I'm just back to working as a freelance journalist, and you know, I've got a few magazine articles in the works, and just thinking about what a second book might hold.
Well, The Price of Gold, The Toll and Triumph of One Man's Olympic Dream. Actually, the book publishes or becomes available June 5th, right after this broadcast. And where can people pick up? Obviously, it's a Rodale publication, but Amazon.com, I imagine. Where else?
You can also purchase it directly from Rodale at theprice of gold book.com.
Oh, very, very cool. Well, I cannot recommend it highly enough, and I think it was just one of the best books about cycling I've ever read. I really enjoyed it, and I'm really glad I was able to get you to talk to me about it even before it got published. Well, I appreciate you taking time this evening, Ian, and lots of luck. Sell lots of copies, and again, I think it's a great book. We will have a link to it on our website.
All right. Thanks
All right.
a lot, Dan.
Have a great night.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Ian Dilley joined us from Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Nice town.
I have never been to Austin, except I do watch the Austin City Limit sometimes, so I've seen little pieces, parts of Austin.
I've been there once. It is a nice place.
It is supposed to be really cool, like the coolest place in Texas.
Yeah. And so now I might have to, you've piqued my interest. I might have to read this book now.
I am telling you, it is one of the best cycling books I've ever read. It just, I was riveted. I am one of these people, of course, who hates to put books down if I like them. So, you know, I read through the whole night. But it's not a hard read. It's just an intense read.
Okay.
I mean, this guy, what he did, some of the things he did to himself to be this incredible, world-class, fastest guy on two wheels on a track. And he was. He was. Oh, yeah. I think he might still hold some world records.
Wow.
It's amazing.
All right, and it's coming out June 5th.
June 5th.
June 5th. All right, I think we've got a couple minutes left here before we should take a break. So why don't we cover a bit of news?
Well, the big news?
Okay.
Shimano.
I saw that.
Everybody saw it. Oh, my goodness. I thought the best coverage was Red Kite Prayer. So Shimano has unveiled its 11-speed Dura-Ace components.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not one group, but two. One mechanical, one electronic.
Mm-hmm.
They are gorgeous. Did you see the brakes?
Yeah, those are
and
hot.
And the derailleurs mm-hmm. are hot. Brian thinks the crank is fugly.
I have to disagree with him on that. I saw that comment earlier in the week on Facebook, and I looked at it, and I'm like, what is ugly about that?
No, I thought it was kind of cool. I liked it, but I am in the minority.
Yeah.
He and Patrick Grady are talking about drinking tequila and making fun of the crank, so who knows?
It has a weird, it's a four-arm spider.
Right.
I think that's
very campy-ish.
Okay.
You know, campy does forearm.
Okay.
And some of the old mountain bike stuff was forearm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's why people may not universally like it, because they're used to seeing a five-arm.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's just the way the black and kind of white looks. You know, it's a very chic group. I think it's going to look stunning on a black bike or a titanium bike or whatever.
I'm sure that it will move the chain round and around.
Yeah, it probably will. That's true. So you and I both want to say good luck to Ram participants, and especially our homegrown girl, Cassie Schumacher.
Yes.
She's on her way out to the West Coast. The event starts on June 16th when riders leave Oceanside, California to race to Annapolis, Maryland. So we will be getting some updates in the meantime, I think. Kat Espino, who was with one of the Ram groups last year and was at our training session that we had at the bike shop,
mm-hmm.
is crewing again this year, and she's on Facebook every day.
Wow.
So I can check that out.
Good. We also want to mention good luck to Team Hope.
Team Hope, Andre Hussein and his group. This is year two?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, yeah. Hope for water.
I think Andre was trying to come back and apply a few lessons learned from last year, so I'm sure that it'll be a smoother and more rewarding experience the second time around.
Yeah, and he is one of those guys who's a vegan, too, so, you know, it'll be interesting. Yeah, it is a challenge. It's a real challenge, because I figure if you're on the bike that many hours, you'll eat anything that's not moving on the plate. Anyway, Ram. Patrick Otisier, a scientific researcher at Boston College and a racer, has decided to add a scientific component to the physical challenge of Ram. This article appeared in an HIV/AIDS blog called The Body. So Otisier is a member of Team 4 HIV Hope, which is a four-man relay team. And two of its members, Stephen, I guess it's Burveling of Sydney, Australia, and Jim Williams of New York, are living with HIV. So Otisier and Glenn Drury of Sydney do not have HIV. And with the combination of racers, Otisier saw an opportunity to take his lab on the road. And with the help of Rob Miller, who is the team doctor, he'll be taking blood draws each day and shipping them back to his lab in Boston. And the aim of the study is to discover the effects of endurance events on both HIV-positive and negative individuals and comparing the two. I think that's interesting, because we all know that lots of exercise seems to benefit the body,
mm-hmm.
regardless of how sort of down and out it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's my news.
All right.
All right.
Let's take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about the Tour of Utah and then wrap up with some triathlon news.
We are indeed.
Right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On Saturday, June 16th, the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network hosts Purple Stride Cleveland at the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo. Purple Stride Cleveland is an event designed to raise awareness and funding in the fight against pancreatic cancer, the fourth leading cause of cancer deaths in the United States. More information and online registration at purplestride.org. Or call toll-free 877-272-6226.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and let's take a trip out west.
To Salt Lake City.
Yep, talk to a guy who's instrumental in putting on the Tour of Utah.
Yes, we are going to talk right now to Steve Miller, president of the Tour of Utah. Steve, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I want you to give us a little bit of background about Steve Miller and the Tour of Utah, since they seem to be somewhat synonymous.
Well, I don't know how that came to be. I can tell you a little bit about myself. I am one of four sons in a family that owns quite a number of automobile dealerships. There's 46 automotive dealerships in seven western states. And we that's part of what we do. We also have, on the sports and entertainment side of our company, we own the Utah Jazz professional basketball team, the arena that they play in. We own about 200 movie screens in the Intermountain West, the Salt Lake Bees, which is the AAA farm club for the Anaheim Angels, Miller Motorsports Park, and, of course, the Tour of Utah. And it falls to me to operate the Tour of Utah within this company, this group of companies.
Wow. Okay, then. So when did this Tour of Utah, the country's toughest stage race, start?
Well, it started, I don't know when the actual genesis was. Our organization got involved back in 2004. We became a sponsor of the event in 2004, 2005. Our involvement grew over time into 2006. After 2006, we actually ended up taking the event and folding it into our umbrella, our group of companies. In 2007, we went dark because we were pretty good at running sports and entertainment properties, but cycling was new to us. So in 2007, we did not put an event on. We just figured we went dark, as I said. We figured that we'd put a game plan in place to make sure that when we really went to market with this product, that it would be sustainable and that it would have a good long-term viability plan. So in 2008, we came back to market with kind of a new, bigger, better, improved version of the event, and it's really just been onward and upward since then.
Well, it seems to have grown rather exponentially. Is this a pro-am event or just a professional event?
Yeah, up until last year, it was a pro-am event, which gave us a lot of latitude to invite, kind of a potpourri of teams, some good high-level national race calendar teams,
right,
perennial all-stars, as well as some amateurs from local clubs and so forth. But when we became a UCI event last year, that put us on par with really the biggest races in the world and precludes us from inviting kind of those lower tier teams that look to get in into the big races. But now the upside is that we have the best of the best. I mean, we have teams racing in the Tour of Utah that are racing the Grand Tours of Europe, Tour de France, Vuelta a España, Giro d'Italia. We have household names. I mean, for those that aren't really familiar with cycling, it would be akin to having, you know, the New York Yankees or
right,
the Chicago Bulls racing in your right own backyard.
Well, and of course, our listeners are, you know, tuned into all of the spring classics and,
yep,
you know, just waiting patiently or impatiently for the tour to come up. So how many pro teams will be racing this year? Do you already have your roster complete?
There's going to be 16 teams racing.
Okay.
We've announced the first eight. And five of the first eight teams announced are all Pro Tour teams.
Wow.
So
wow.
We have BMC Racing is coming. We have Garmin Barracuda. We have Leaky Gas Cannondale. We have Rabobank. We have Radio Shack Nissan Trek. We also have some other household names in, at least in this neck of the woods, competitive cyclists received an invite. They're headquartered right here in Park City, Utah.
Right.
A Colombian team accepted an invitation, EPM UNE. Argo Shimano from the Netherlands will be here, which is one T for I. And then, of course, in the next, hopefully 10 to 14 days, we'll have the balance, the remaining eight teams announced. And there is another Pro Tour team that if you did some math, it wouldn't be tough to figure out who that sixth Pro Tour team is going
to
be.
Well, we'll just leave it to the imagination for the short term. I mean, you know, people are going, well, what about? So they can just what about for a while.
Well,
so,
they can, but, you know, I think that it would be safe to say that the defending champion of the Tour of Utah will be back to defend.
There you go.
Was
it difficult to become a UCI event?
Not terribly. What we had done, I mentioned a little while ago that in 2007 we went dark, we put a game plan together. Part of that game plan was to become a UCI event in a 3 to 5 year time span.
Okay.
And so we knew that there were certain markers that we would have to meet, certain things we would have to do in order to qualify, and we systematically started chipping away at those. We knew that we would have to put on a very safe event. We knew that there would be, that we would be measured. You actually invite commissaires to come, and they literally attend your event, and they just go through almost a checkbook of, okay, how was this handled? How was check-in handled? Were the routes well marked? And so on and so forth. And after you've done that for a couple of years, then you do you apply for sanctioning at the UCI level, and it's either granted or it's not granted. And fortunately for us, on our first application, it was accepted.
Well, obviously, you did what you were supposed to do.
Well, we try, and that's, you know, we had a lot of help from USA Cycling. Steve Johnson and his crew
right.
came out to the event multiple times. And they rode in the comm cars, and I literally rode side by side with those guys. And I had my pen and paper out, and I was asking them, okay, guys, from your eyes, what do we need to do? What do we need to change? How can we be better? And with their help, we really put a plan in place to make sure that we were locked down and that we were ready to kind of race with the big boys, if you will.
So this year, there's a new component to the tour, and it does allow for a few amateurs to apply to race. Would you explain how the Epic Endurance Bucket List race experience with Carmichael is going to work?
Sure. This is really a unique opportunity for those that would really want to get the race experience and see what it's like to be a pro without having to accumulate the points or, you know, go through all the heartache and aggravation of racing and doing to your body what it takes to race at the pro level.
Right.
So it's not for the recreational cyclist. It's for somebody who's in very, very good condition. You actually have to apply for the opportunity to take advantage of the race experience or the Epic Endurance Bucket List race experience with Carmichael Training Systems. There will be, I think there are 12 spots open. We've already sold 8, maybe 9 of those spots.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But what you do is you apply for it through Carmichael, and then they will do an interview with you. And if you're accepted, Carmichael will put a training plan together for you between now and the race that will help you prepare to race every single stage of the Tour of Utah ahead of the pros. So the pros will leave, let's just say that they leave at 11 a.m.
Right.
on a given day.
Right.
You and 11 others that were accepted to the program will leave at, say, 7 in the morning, and you'll leave the same start line that the pros do, and you'll race the exact same course that the pros are racing.
And hope not to get lapped.
And I don't think they will.
No, probably not.
Yeah, and then when you're done, you get, you know, there's a soigneur, there's care, there's the support vehicles follow you just like the pros. It's the same experience as the pros. Now, there's not as many fans lining the course because they typically don't come out until a little bit later, but you'll get the vast majority of the experience. They'll actually even get to eat breakfast with the pros in the same room that the pros are eating in, as well as dinner. And so it's as close to being a pro and experiencing what the pros experience without actually being on a pro team.
Who came up with this idea? It's a great idea.
It is. It's a neat idea. I think it was Chris Carmichael's brainchild. First time I saw it, I think, was 2 years ago at the Tour of California. And I said, all right, that we need to incorporate that into the Tour of Utah, but we're not quite ready for it yet. Put it on a to-do list. And then Chris and I got together in January of this year and kind of worked on the details. And we said, let's start small and see where it goes. We figured that if we sold 10 or 12 spots, it would be a success, and they started selling just about the minute that we put them on the market.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Steve Miller, who's the president of the Tour of Utah, which is coming up first week of August, yes?
August 7th through the 12th.
Yeah. Very cool. So there are 5 road stages and a time trial and a lot of climbing. So you build this race as America's toughest stage race. How would it compare, do you think, to some of the tough races in Europe?
That's a great question. And we use, the measuring stick that we use for that is we ask the pros. In fact, we ask for input from the pro teams and the directors before we build, or as we're building the courses, we look for feedback, and we don't want to make the race so difficult that teams don't want to come.
Yeah, sure.
But we want to make it difficult enough that there are big bragging rights that come with winning a stage here or with winning a jersey here.
Sure.
And we think we've struck a pretty good balance with all of that. Now, at one point, I think it was either last year or the year before, in an interview, Levi Leipheimer said of the Queen stage of the Tour of Utah, which is a perennial favorite here, he said that it is as beautiful and as difficult as any of the Grand Tour stages that he's ridden in.
Well, that's a pretty good statement, I would say.
Yeah, and that's so, but the thing about Utah is you could throw a dart at a map of Utah and you could put a stage of the Tour of Utah in that vicinity and not go wrong. It's a beautiful state.
Is there going to be television coverage of this Tour of Utah?
There is.
Ooh, cool.
We're very pleased to be able to offer the final 2 hours of all 6 stages live on Fox Sports Network.
Wow.
Every market will carry it, which we're very, very proud of. So we'll have 2 hours of live racing daily. And then in addition to that, we're going to do a one-hour recap every night in all the local markets on Fox Sports still at 11 p.m.
Very cool.
Yeah, it'll be televised live from 4 to 6 Eastern, and the live portion will, and then the recap will take place at 11 p.m. locally.
Okay. Yeah. So I have one more really important question, because you have an element in the Tour of Utah that I think is important to the tour, and obviously it's important to somebody else. What is the Echelon Project?
Well, I'm glad you asked. The Echelon Project is... It's a group of not-for-profit organizations that have, as a primary focus, the health and well-being of children. And the goal is to reduce and prevent lifestyle-related diseases and disabilities by promoting health and wellness and well-being in our communities. And we do that by advancing health and wellness education and kids programs and activities and events, and by supporting organizations that are looking to achieve childhood health and wellness as their primary mission. And so Eric Heiden's Foundation, the Play Well, Play Safe Foundation, has joined it, the Boys and Girls Clubs, the Utah Department of Health. There's a lot of this is our first year folding that into the tour, and it's really been quite successful so far. It's really quite pleasing to see how it's been embraced.
Good. I wanted to get that in there for sure, because we speak a lot on the show about safe routes to school and talk to a lot of people who are involved in children's causes for things like diabetes and obesity and some of the asthma, some of the things that are affecting kids today, that we would like to see all those things go away and get kids outside playing again.
We do. We just need to get them off the couch, and we need to get them on bicycles and you know, playgrounds, and we need to get them outside.
That's right.
It's a scary track that a lot of our kids are on.
I know. So, lastly, tell us the dates of the tour again and where people can get information online.
The dates of the tour, August 7th through the 12th.
Okay.
It's a 6-day event, and the tour website is tourofutah.com.
Simple enough. All right.
I'd just like to add that for the second year in a row, we will be streaming the race live in its entirety from start to finish.
Wow.
So if you can't pick it up on Fox Sports, the 2 hours live, just log on to tourofutah.com, click on the tour tracker button, and we'll be carrying it live in HD.
Well, I wish you so much luck with the tour this year, and maybe in 2013 I'll be able to actually get out of my retail store and get out there and watch the tour with you. I would really like that.
We would love to have you out.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. Good luck, and have a great tour.
Thanks so much.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Steve Miller joined us from Salt Lake City, Utah. They're getting ready to put on a very important, very challenging bike race.
What I like is that we actually have a race that can rival some of the European courses. And, I mean, Utah is a rugged state.
All right, we're going to wrap up this hour by talking about triathlon.
Yes, we are. So the father of triathlon, and as I said in the opening, anybody who's ever tried to do a triathlon probably owns Joe Friel's The Triathlon Training Bible. So we got Joe to tell us if you want to start riding and racing and swimming and biking a triathlon for the first time, he's got the new book. So let's welcome Joe to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening, Joe.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Glad to be here.
Great. So I don't think there are many more people who've been involved with triathlons as long or as deeply as you have. You want to give us a little background about you and your involvement in the sport of triathlon?
Sure. I did my first triathlon in 1982 after having been a runner for many, many years. And actually in 1980, at the time I started doing triathlon, I owned a running store in Fort Collins, Colorado. The next year, 1983, after I started doing triathlons, I bought the bike store next to my running store, took out the wall between them, and I had what must have been the very first triathlon store in the world. We were selling Speedo, swim gear, and several lines of bikes, and all the major running shoe brands and other source accessories. So I've been around the sport for a long time. Started coaching triathletes in the about the same time, probably about 83, 84, 85, right around there. Started coaching triathletes, and I've been doing it ever since.
Your new book, which is your first triathlon, Race Ready in 5 Hours a Week, it's the second edition. It's really, really well laid out. I enjoyed getting through it, and it would make almost anybody be ready to at least try a triathlon. But I think a lot of people think it's difficult, if not arduous. And you don't really believe that. So what would you define, or would you define the different triathlon events for us? The different, okay. Because I remember only when I started out, half Ironman, Ironman. Things have evolved.
Yeah, they really have. Yeah, distances have evolved over the last, gosh, since I got in the sport, I guess in my 30-some years. But back in the 80s, the primary distance really was what was called USTS distance at that time. That was United States Triathlon Series. They're the ones who initiated what today we call the Olympic distance, you know, 1,500-meter swim, 40K bike, 10K run. That grew out of the USTS race series in the U.S., they faded out in the early 90s, but their distance stayed with us. Roughly half that distance was called the sprint distance. And then about the same, actually earlier than USTS was the Ironman, with the very first triathlons, of course, in Hawaii, 1978.
Right.
And that distance has remained pretty much the same ever since. Yeah, so it's, a 3,800-meter swim, 180 kilometers, 112 bike, and then run a marathon. And that's stayed the same over the years. And then out of that grew the half marathon, which sprang up not too many years down the road from the full Ironman, did the half Ironman appear. So those are the four primary distances yet today.
When did triathlon actually get into the Olympics? Not terribly long ago.
2000 in Sydney.
Yeah, okay. So this will be the fourth one coming up.
Fourth one, yeah, that's right.
Let's talk a little bit about the three different elements of triathlon. So in your experience, and you have a ton of experience, do you think a newcomer to the sport finds swimming, biking, or running the most daunting?
Well, it kind of depends on their background, I guess. If they come from a, any of those sport backgrounds, that's the easy one. The other two always appear daunting. But I guess what it really comes down to is I think the most difficult are swimming and running, quite honestly, for people to become proficient at, to be able to train at. The problem with swimming is you have to learn a technique, and it's really not about fitness, it's about technique. And that can take a year or more just to develop that method of swimming, that form that requires to be efficient in the water. Water is one of the slowest mediums we can move through, so consequently you've got to be very efficient, otherwise the water just pushes back too hard. So that's the hard part about swimming. Running, the challenge is if you're brand new to running, it takes 2 or 3 years just for your legs to get toughened up, and so you can start avoiding injuries and really start training. First 2 or 3 years, it's just like one injury after another, and so the athlete has to be very, very cautious in what they do so they don't wind up with a bad knee or shin splints or plantar fasciitis or Achilles tendonitis or whatever it may be. Cycling is probably the easiest one to pick up. Most people don't have much trouble getting into it. The biggest challenge there is just really getting comfortable being around cars out on the road. That's the greatest challenge, and the downside is obviously getting hit by a car. The downside is far worse than the other two sports. So each has its own ways of being daunting, I guess. Just depends on what your background is.
Sure, sure. So other than the bicycle, let's look at the biking first, mainly because that's my background, and so I know a lot about bicycles. What do you think is most important for the athlete who is new to cycling, other than a bike, obviously, and you can really jump on any bike and get into one of these beginning races and at least finish, I think. But what do you think is the most important part to make cycling as effective and sort of the part that gets you moving a little faster through the three events?
Yeah, I think the thing most people who are new to the sport really need is a bike fit by somebody who knows what they're doing. Too often their bike, number one, they often have bikes that don't fit them. But if they do have a bike that's the right size for them, then the challenge is that it's set up so poorly that they really can't take advantage of any fitness they may have because they're fighting with the bike just trying to propel it. So doing a bike fit, I think, is the most important thing they can do as far as preparing for the bike. Other than training, of course. As far as the equipment on the bike, I would say for novices, the thing they should really get used to is aero bars. That takes some becoming accustomed to because it's a little bit intimidating at first, a little bit scary because you're not quite as balanced feeling as you are when you're holding on to handlebars. So it takes a while to get used to that. But if they do, once they do, that really does improve their performances a lot, more so than probably anything else they can do at this stage in their triathlon career.
Let's move a little bit to the daunting pool. For people who have only been swimming in a pool, how do you get them to adapt to open water and not be scared half to death? Because I think that is a problem for a lot of new swimmers.
It is. Open water swimming is very intimidating for people who have not done it before. The first few times, in fact, it can go on for a long, long time. The athlete has to learn to be calm before they get into the water. There's lots of excitement the morning of a race. Blood pressure is high. The heart rate is beating real fast. And so consequently, it's hard to calm yourself down. There's just the sense of getting into murky water, not being able to see very far, but lots of people around you can be very intimidating. It just takes lots of practice. It starts in the pool. You have to start in the pool by working on skills that are going to be used in open water. Open water swimming is a little bit different as far as technique than pool swimming. I won't go into the details of all that stuff here, just a different way of moving through the water. And part of that has to do with sighting, which is something that can be learned in the pool. It doesn't do you much good to become really good swimmer if you swim the wrong direction in the race. So you've got to learn how to sight off of landmarks so you move in a relatively straight line towards your destination rather than swimming some sort of wiggly way of getting across the water. So that can be learned in the pool, just a matter of working on technique and how you're going to sight, how you raise your head up out of the water and look to see where you're going and then get back into swimming technique again. So I would say as far as skill of sighting and as far as the mental side, preparation for open water swimming, it's mostly just calmness. It's getting oneself under control and realizing there's really nothing to be afraid of in the water itself. It may be kind of murky looking and so forth, but really nothing's going to happen other than you're just going to swim in the water. As long as you don't start right in the front of a race, you're not going to wind up with lots of people beating up on you. Sometimes it's called the washing machine right there in the middle. So if you stay to the perimeter toward the back, it's really not a difficult experience whatsoever.
So let me take a moment and remind our listeners, we're speaking with Joe Friel. He has written yet another book. He has at least 10 that I know of. This one's Your First Triathlon, Race Ready in 5 Hours a Week. So what do you think are the most important goals that you might want to reach moving from, say, your Olympic or sprint distance and say you want to do a half Ironman?
Yeah, to move up, I like to see athletes do that over a period of 2 or 3 years. I've known too many athletes to start into the sport immediately doing a half Ironman or even, heaven forbid, an Ironman as their very first triathlon. It looks very easy when you see other people do it, but it's not easy at all. It's quite intimidating when you get those long courses. So it's a matter of, first of all, taking the time to get into it gradually rather than trying to jump into it. And moving up through the distances, doing several sprint distance races and then several Olympic distance races before even considering doing the first half Ironman, I think is a wise move for athletes. I think if people do that, they'll find that they progress rather easily. And it's just a matter of when you do your first half Ironman of training for it, of just going to longer distances at a somewhat slower intensity. And, over time, the body will adapt. It really won't be that difficult on race day if you've come up through the sport for 2 or 3 years before you try it. But the very first time out of the chute, trying a half Ironman for your first triathlon is simply not a good idea.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. It's like trying to do a century and you haven't been on the bike yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you also have a really nice section in the book on nutrition and weight loss. And I know a lot of people get into sports like cycling, like swimming, and expect to lose weight and not just get fit. Can you cover a couple of the tips that are in that chapter?
Sure. What it comes down to for most people is, first of all, let me back up one step. Most triathletes become very, very aware of what they eat. When you start putting in a lot of training time and you have high goals, you realize you can't be doing things like eating junk food all the time and expect to be able to perform at a high level. And the older you get, the more critical that becomes. Young athletes, quite honestly, can get away with eating almost anything they want, and they're still going to do quite all right. But you get athletes in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and older, food becomes really critical, the type of foods they eat. So it's a matter of watching what you eat. I think most everybody already knows the answer to the question, what should I eat? It's really not that complicated. But what I generally suggest to people is that they really focus their diet on some really basic things, vegetables, fruit, lean protein. Those should be really the primary things we're eating all the time. Then we need to be eating certain types of foods to recover after longer workouts, harder workouts. And that would be starchy foods, potatoes, cereal, bread, bagels, corn, rice. Those are all very starchy foods. They're a bit low on the micronutrient side, nutrients such as vitamins and minerals. They're very high when it comes to carbohydrate, and we need to keep our carbohydrate stores filled. But typically the person who's new to the sport, training 5 or 6 or 7 hours a week, doesn't really need all that concerned with how much starch they get in their diet. They really don't need to replace a lot of carbohydrates. They're not using all that much, quite honestly. So really all that person needs to do is if they eat a lot of fruit, they will take care of their carbohydrate needs very easily. As soon as the athlete moves beyond about an hour a day of training, the amount of starch they get in their diet becomes much more critical. We get to somebody who's training 12, 14, 16, 18 hours a week, they've got to eat a lot of carbohydrate, a lot of starch, just because they've got to replace all that glycogen, that carbohydrate, stored carbohydrate they've burned. So it's not really too complex as long as we just kind of pay attention to things like that.
Well, so you really do believe that you can train 5 hours a week and do a triathlon?
You can do a sprint distance triathlon in 5 hours a week.
That is awesome. Well, the book is wonderful, and you have a lot of books, and you have a great website that you can see the rest of the books. But would you tell people where they can get a copy of your new book, your first triathlon, Race Ready in 5 hours a Week?
Certainly. You can go to my blog. In fact, on my blog, if you scan down just a little bit, I think it's like the second entry on the blog right now, newest. There's actually the first chapter from my book is available for anybody that wants to read it.
Oh, cool. Very cool. What's the blog address?
It's Joe Freels. Let me spell that. JoeFrielS blog, B-L-O-G, .com. JoeFrielsBlog.com.
And we'll put a link up on the station site also.
Great.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me this evening. You are the guru master of triathlon, and I know you do lots of coaching, and you just coached us through how to do a triathlon. That was pretty cool. Thanks.
Thank you, Diane. Appreciate
All right.
It.
Well, have a great night.
Thanks.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Joe Freel joined us from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Make you want to do a try?
Not at all.
Oh. Okay, then.
If you could just get rid of that swimming part and that running part, triathlon would be my number one favorite sport.
I see.
I do find it interesting that you start with the least efficient method of human propulsion, swimming, and then you go to the most efficient method, biking, and you wind up kind of in the middle with running.
Well, and there has been some question and controversy as to the order of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it is what it is. It's been this way for a long time. And I don't know. I've never wanted to actually do a triathlon. I was a race director for an Ironman half Ironman for 3 years. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. These people. You thought Marty Notstein was intense? You should meet some triathletes. Oh, my goodness.
I ride with some tri geeks once in a while. You know, they say that the biking leg is really just so you can recover for the swim to get ready for the run.
Oh, boo.
That's what they tell me.
Oh, give me a break.
That's what they tell
me. Give me a break. I see. We're just going to tool along for 112 miles recovering for that marathon. I don't think so.
Well, it's the most efficient way to move yourself. So it probably is easier than swimming or running in terms of, you know.
Yeah, I guess.
Required.
But what I find is people who aren't cyclists who do triathlon really often don't have a respect for the bicycle that I think they should. Now, except for people like John Howard, who was a cyclist first.
Mm-hmm.
Or Lance Armstrong actually was a triathlete first.
He was a triathlete first, yeah.
But he certainly did garner respect for the bike,
and
do you think?
And he's a triathlete now.
He's done some tries.
Yeah.
So he is.
Okay, well.
We ought to try ourselves to get right out of here.
This is
huh?
not the outspoken triathlete.
No. It's because neither of us like to swim, bike, and run.
But if that's your thing, more power to you.
Yeah.
And Joe's book will help you out.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll help ourselves out of here.
Okay.
But never fear to return next week with another edition.
We will indeed.
All right. Ride safely until then.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.